something that really bothered me was is that, like, as a kid growing up, I always thought if you made a certain amount of money, like, you'd be doing really well. I'm going to date myself by saying this, but back then it was like, if you earn six figures, you're like rich. Like, yeah. That's not true anymore, but back then it was, right? And then I started earning that kind of money and I wasn't rich. I was like, what the heck is going on? How come I'm not like have piles and piles of money sitting around? I can just like, you know, buy whatever I want. And then these guys that I met started explaining inflation to me. And then it started finally clicking in my head. I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me they just keep printing money over and over and over again. And that's the reason that prices are going up. It's not because these things are more valuable. It's because the dollars are all dropping in purchasing power. That blew my mind.
Really?
Now, if you target a 2% rate of inflation compounding year over year, every 35 years-ish, you're going to lose half your purchasing power.
Yeah.
So if you live to 70 years old, that happens twice in your life. So half your wealth gets taken from you twice.
Wow.
In a lifetime. That's at 2%. It's probably a lot higher than
but
that.
But you're describing the United States, and the United States is like the nicest house on a shitty street.
Basically, modern Keynesian economists, they're going to tell you that a certain amount of inflation is absolutely necessary for a healthy economy, which I actually think that's kind of insane if you think about it.
We don't learn Austrian economics in school. They purposely skipped that chapter.
It took like the United States over 200 years to do the first $1 trillion in debt. Man, we're doing another $1 trillion every 70 days.
That's fucking insane.
If Bitcoin is going up in value, let's say 30 to 40% a year, and it's beating every other asset in existence, it finally provides you some hope that you're not going to be stuck on that hamster wheel forever.
Down a rabbit hole.
Down.
Cypherpunk.
Welcome to Cypherpunked, where we explore money's history, crypto's future, and Web3's role in advancing human rights, freedom, and digital liberty. Today's guest is Alex Stanzik, a combat veteran turned Bitcoin advisor who's guided family offices through over $1 billion in Bitcoin acquisitions. Before becoming a Bitcoin maximalist, Alex ran a physical gold fund for nearly a decade, giving him a unique perspective on the evolution of hard assets. Now a part-time farmer and freedom maximalist, he's known for his sharp market commentary and contrarian takes that keep the Bitcoin community on its toes, not to mention a new podcast that I've been hearing about.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me, man. I appreciate it.
Welcome back to the show, my man.
Thank you. Thank you.
We had a fun little panel earlier.
Oh, it was great. Yeah. So we were talking to the folks from Bitcoin Well.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool people. And that is a Bitcoin maxi company right there.
Mm-hmm. No doubt.
The only option, from what I understand, is straight to self-custody.
I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So that's very interesting.
It saves me a lot of work with our Bitcoin meetup, because usually it's been, like I said, just like teaching them how to like buy on Coinbase. And then eventually we do the self-custody thing when they're ready.
Yeah.
But this is just like kind of skips all that. And they help with the onboarding, which I think is super cool. So they will take the call and like walk through the person on how to do it and stuff, which is kind of a unique thing. You don't see a lot of companies that are that involved, which.
Yeah. Well, some are. I mean, you're not going to see Coinbases do stuff like that. When I worked at Swan, we used to do that. I bet you some of the other companies that are there are some companies that are very mission focused and they have no problem doing stuff like that. Because at the end of the day, what they're really trying to do is do the best thing for the people that are interested in Bitcoin. It's not just a business. It's more about like, how can we actually help these people? They genuinely care. And so we helped a lot of people do that, but that's very cool. It's a lot of hard work. Like, you know, teaching somebody how to do self-custody sometimes takes a minute.
Oh, it does.
Trust me, no doubt.
Yeah, no,
there's reps involved and like, you know, it's just one of those things where it takes some time.
Like when I help people do it, I like, you know, I'll be there to guide them, but they have to like go through, like I usually help them set up like a ledger or something like that. So what I like about the ledger is like they have the, like there's not too much there, but you have to actually read it. It's like, read this, don't give this and like, I make them read it and go through it and do it themselves instead of like kind of got like helping them do it, like do it for them.
Yeah.
You have to actually do it.
Yeah.
So important.
Well, it's kind of,
you have
like,
to understand it.
Well, it's like anything that, has any kind of real potential risk to it. You have to understand what you're doing. It's like when you learn how to drive a car, you have to understand all the parts about driving the car.
No
right?
doubt. Yeah.
If you're going skydiving, you better understand
how to pull the parachute.
What's going on there, right? So like, you know, I'm a firearms instructor. So if you're learning how to use firearms, you probably better pay attention to the various different steps. And there's 100% self-responsibility when it comes to that kind of stuff. Like, you know, you're responsible for what happens. And the same is true. And this is, I think, part of what scares people is that the finality of it all, like when you send Bitcoin on chain, like, you better make sure you put in the right address.
Better not add an extra D or an F at the end of that, or an extra zero, you know? So yeah, there is something, a lot of people, like even people that work for me, it's like, you know, they're very scared the first time they send a big transaction. Sure. And it's like, hey, Maddie, come here.
Well,
double check this.
And that's good, right? There's nothing wrong with that. But I think the trick and the key there is that you just start out small.
Yep.
Right. Like if you send $20, let's call it, you're not necessarily as worried. And I'm not going to suggest to people that you should be sending transactions that small because there's other issues, right?
Yep.
But if you're learning how to do it, you need to get reps doing it before you feel comfortable. Just like anything else, you want to have reps.
So Alex, tell me about Swan. How did you end up at Swan and why did you leave Swan? And now you have a new podcast. So tell me about that too.
Sure. Okay. So, I guess I'd need to start with gold because gold is what switched me on to understanding money. Like prior to getting involved in gold, I did a couple of different things. I was in the military and then I was in the IT industry. I was the director of IT for an aerospace union. And then I launched a little tech company on the side, ended up moving down to Central America where I met a couple of guys and they started teaching me about inflation. And up until this point, I mean, I thought I was a fairly well read and I mean, I thought I understood business a little bit. I didn't understand economics as much. Something that really bothered me was that, like, as a kid growing up, I always thought if you made a certain amount of money, like, you'd be doing really well. I'm going to date myself by saying this, but back then it was like, if you earn six figures, you're like rich. Like that's not true anymore, but back then it was, right? And then I started earning that kind of money and I wasn't rich. I was like, what the heck is going on? How come I'm not like have piles and piles of money sitting around? I can just like, you know, buy whatever I want. And then they started, you know, these guys that I met started explaining inflation to me. And then it started finally clicking in my head. I'm like, wait a minute, you're telling me that they just keep printing money over and over and over again. And all the money that you've got becomes worth the, and that's the reason that prices are going up. It's not because these things are more valuable. It's because the dollars are all dropping in purchasing power. That blew my mind.
Really?
They don't
teach you that in school. You're perfect. Like,
no,
you don't learn Austrian economics in school. They purposely skip that chapter.
Yeah. And if you talk to any basically modern Keynesian economists, they're going to tell you that a certain amount of inflation is absolutely necessary for a healthy economy.
Yeah.
Which I actually think that's kind of insane if you think about it.
Have you read Jeff Booth's book?
Oh, absolutely. Love Jeff Booth. Like, he's an extremely intelligent guy. In fact, he was one of the first guests on my new pod, which is called The Bitcoin Crucible, by the way.
Love it.
So one of the very first episodes, and we deep dive into that.
I'm trying to get him to do it. Like, my favorite thing to do with this is like to do book series with authors. Like I did Larry with The Big Print. I did my friend Dominic Frisbee, who wrote Daylight Robbery, The History of Taxes.
Okay.
I did Aaron Van Weerdem, who's got the Genesis book. I think Paul, our producer, said that Natalie Brunell said that she's going to do a series on her book here soon in the next coming months. So I love doing that. We've been trying to align Jeff for forever to come to this. Like, we've been playing tag back and forth to find a week or two that makes sense.
Right on.
But, you know,
he's a great guy. He's a very, he's one of the best thinkers in the space, I think.
Yeah.
But back to the story, I got involved in the gold industry, ended up managing a gold fund, as you mentioned, for a little while. And that's kind of what brought me to Bitcoin and eventually to Swan. Is that at one point I figured out that Bitcoin was essentially better than gold in every way that mattered. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of 2020, I started to realize I really needed to switch industries. I mean, I was literally talking to investors in my fund about gold, hang up the phone. I'm like reading books about Bitcoin. At one point, I'm like, man, you know, this is like.
I talked to Bobby Iacino about this, and like I personally own some gold. Like, I don't I don't hate gold at all. I just think Bitcoin is superior.
Right, exactly. Same.
What about gold do you like more than Bitcoin? That's an interesting question for you.
If I have to pick something, I would say it's essentially indestructible. Mm-hmm. That's one part that I think is really fascinating. So you can't really destroy gold. I mean, for practical purposes, I suppose you could melt it down with acid and then wash it down the drain. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the gold atoms are still there.
Yeah, it still goes somewhere.
It's still there. Mm-hmm. But for all practical purposes, there's not really anything. I mean, gold is interesting because when you hold it in your hands, the weight of it is interesting. Mm-hmm. Like you ever seen those bricks, the 400 ounce bricks? Yep. Like they,
those things are heavy, man.
Yeah. They're 12 and a half kilos, I believe is what it, you know, so it comes out to almost 30 pounds and it's deceiving because they don't look that heavy, but when you hold them, it's like, and it's interesting because, so I used to go over to Switzerland just about every year and we'd audit, you know, we'd look at the gold in the vault. We'd visit the refineries, all that other kind of stuff. And like, I would occasionally bring people with me to the vaults. And when you first hold these things in your hands, man, every single time they get this gigantic grin on their face. And I don't care how cool you are.
Yeah, like, I know.
Everybody gets a huge grin on their face the first time. And I can remember being at conferences, like there were conferences we went to in Switzerland where it was a financial conference, right? And we would bring a gold bar or two from the vault and we would have security cases, like glass cases, and we'd have dudes standing there with bulletproof vests and machine guns and the whole deal, guarding them the whole time. And like during the whole conference, you'd see people like from traditional finance, they would walk by and they kind of look at the gold sideways as they go by and they don't want to say anything, you know, but by the end of the conference, they're like, cause we were letting people hold them, right? We would unlock the case. We'd take it out. You could hold it. By the end of the conference, all the TradFi guys were coming by and they're like, hey man, can I hold that thing?
Can I hold the gold?
Yeah. So that's,
oh man. Yeah. I think, gold has the history, man. It's got the history of humanity.
For sure.
Most human, civilizations flourishing, you know, like there's something special there, right? Like it's,
For sure.
I think Larry calls it God's money or somebody says that. It's like
a lot of people in the gold industry say,
call it God's money.
Say that. Yeah.
And you know, obviously it's not like people just picked gold. There is a reason that gold was selected. There was a fundamental underlying characteristic why gold was selected by people to use as money before we had the ability to have something like Bitcoin, right?
Sure.
It's this precursor to that, right?
Yeah.
You know, just in the same way why people used a wheel and horses and, you know, carriages before they were able to make a combustible engine and have a car, right? It's like an evolution there.
But it's interesting you bring that up because basically what you're talking about is that it gold became chosen by the free market because it was a superior monetary technology.
Yeah.
That's actually the key.
Yeah.
It wasn't because God said, you shall now use
there gold. You go. Exactly.
It was because it was superior as a monetary technology. It had these attributes.
Inherent characteristics fundamentally that made it a better money.
Yeah. At that time, right. And the thing about humanity is that we continue to stack technology. And this is where I kind of diverge from most gold investors. Cause when gold investors typically talk about Bitcoin nowadays, they'll say, well, gold doesn't require electricity and gold doesn't need the internet. And it's like, okay, that's true. But what you're really saying when you say that is that you think gold is better because what? We're going to be cavemen again?
You're right. I mean, that's why gold eventually failed as money for this exact reason.
Like,
wasn't able to, you know, you weren't able to send it around like very quickly. It didn't have these inherent, you weren't able to, you know, move gold through space and time super quickly. It was,
But the implication is that we're not going to have the internet. We're not going to have electricity. And it's like, look, man, if we don't have the internet and we don't have electricity, we got a lot bigger problems.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
The one that I always hear is, you know, what happens if the internet goes out? And I tell people, well, like, what are you going to be the one shooting down 20,000 satellites, beaming the internet all over the earth and all these satellite structures that Elon's got with Starlink and then all these other, you know, countries and nations are throwing up there? Like, good luck. What if the power goes out? Okay, the power goes out. I mean, you still got Starlink satellites beaming down and solar panels and stuff.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, it's a hard thing to believe. I mean, you're looking at like civilizational reset.
Yeah,
and I
you just got bigger problems. I don't even think gold's going to help you so much right away when that happens. I mean, you better have guns. You better have money, and you better have some food of some sort.
Precisely,
not money.
Water.
I mean, yeah,
water.
You better have tools and water and food.
Yeah, a way to consistently get more food because even if you have a stockpile of food, that's going to run out at some point.
Yeah, true. Right? True.
So, you have to have a way to get water, a way to get food, all the things, right?
Word on the street is you're a farmer, man. You're doing some farming. What about all that?
So yeah, a little bit. Like it's more like a hobby farm kind of a thing. We've got some chickens, got some horses, you know.
So if shit hits the fan, I know I'm going to have to find you.
Yeah, you're welcome.
I'll do the labor. You just tell me what to do.
All right. You got it. You got it.
As long as I don't have to kill. I don't like killing things. I feel like I'd probably die pretty quickly because I could only like make eggs. Like, everything else, I'd feel too guilty killing an animal or something.
I don't know, man. Hopefully we won't go there.
I hope you're right. Yeah. Oh, man. So why'd you decide to do a new podcast?
I just like to educate people, teach people about Bitcoin, because I think Bitcoin is really hope for humanity. I mean, as a gold investor, that was one of the most depressing periods of my life. Now gold investors are pretty excited. Gold has done really well. Congratulations to all the gold investors out there. It's done really well in the last year or so. But prior to that, it was a slog, man.
Do you think that the gold market was being manipulated? I know a lot of people talk about this. And
yeah, look, I think short-term manipulation is not even speculative. Mm-hmm. Like there's proof that lots of bullion banks did this over time. In the short term, I mean, they've got billions of dollars of fines over it. So, I mean, that's not a question of whether they were doing it. They were. Mm-hmm. I think the bigger question is a lot of people who invest in gold think there's an overall price suppression scheme that's kept the price of gold down for an extended period of time. I think that's a lot harder to prove. I'm not so sure about that. I think I'm not going to say it's impossible, but I think it would be very difficult. But at the end of the day, I mean, you're starting to see when you look at exponential, or I should say not exponential, but compounding functions in math, if you look at them on a graph, they go like this for a really long period of time. Mm-hmm. It looks almost flat. Mm-hmm. And then all of a sudden it turns a corner. It goes straight up.
Yeah.
Right. So I feel like we're in the straight up part. Like have you ever looked at a chart of gold lately and go back to like the 1900s versus today? It's crazy. It literally looks like it's going straight up.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so,
that's how a Bitcoin chart looks, obviously, because that's exactly what's happened.
Sure. That's how Bitcoin looks as well. Yeah. But interestingly, like if you think about it, so it took like the United States over 200 years to do the first $1 trillion in debt. And we're doing another $1 trillion every 70 days.
That's fucking insane. It's hard to even fathom. I read, it was like when they printed all the COVID money, apparently the stat that I heard was it took, you know, basically in 1 year, they added 50% of all the dollars that took like hundreds of years to create.
Yeah.
It's kind of wild.
It's kind of wild, but it also explains a lot of things, right? Yeah. Like the prices of things are skyrocketing. I'm trying to remember what it was. I had a subscription the other day. It was like maybe Apple TV or something. It was just one of those basic kind of subscriptions where I think I was paying like $10 a month and all of a sudden it shot up to like $15 or $16.
Wow.
Who in 1 year.
Like that, yeah.
In 1 year, right? So that's like... And I'm sure other people notice this. I mean, one of the best indicators is go look how much it costs for a pound of prime rib. Right?
Wow.
Like anybody who is paying attention to that stuff knows that the 3% rate of inflation that's officially reported probably isn't super accurate.
Yeah. It's not like the government has any incentive to lie about that.
Oh, yeah.
It's actually fascinating how many schemes they've come up with. Like this idea of hedonic adjustments, like, hey, we know this car is inflated massively, but you don't have to manually roll your windows up anymore. Now you just press a button. So that justifies this increase. And we don't account that to inflation.
and this is nothing new. Like if you look through history, you look at every government that's ever had this problem where the money is where they've got this inflation issue. And as it starts to get worse, in almost every single case, they misreport the numbers. Mm-hmm. Like you just ask any country that's gone through this, right? Mm-hmm. And the people will tell you, the government will say one thing, but it's actually whatever it is, right?
Do you know, are you familiar with the guy who runs like Shadow Stats?
I have heard of this guy. I used to, when I was a gold guy, I used to pay much more close attention to what
they just keep changing how they do the formula to like try to make it not look so bad. Like if something inflates massively 1 month, they just like, oh, we're not going to count that anymore. We'll take that one out or, you know, and then what makes me laugh is the stuff that they disclude from the metric, which is like the most important stuff, like food and rent, like shit like that.
All the things we actually pay for.
All the things that actually matter to the poorest people specifically who have to find shelter and food and rent and pay gas for the car. Like the most important thing is like, oh, we'll just take that out of the metric. You know, everything, worry about everything else. Right. No, that makes me laugh. Yeah. So,
I mean, there's two sides of it. You know what I mean? Like, if you're if you're good at business and you're good at getting out there and getting after it, then when you have a highly inflationary environment, that's actually good because you're going to make more money.
You know, what's interesting about that is that the panel yesterday with Grant, when he basically fucking said that.
Exactly.
That was such an interesting moment. I was like, this motherfucker just said, and Grant's we talk all the time, but he just basically described the Cantillon effect. He's like, I'm going to get that money first and I'm going to go out and like, he probably doesn't even made it clear. He's like, I don't understand all this shit, but like, here is like what I'm going to do. And it was it was basically like the Cantillon effect explained. He's like, I'm going to go get that money and I'm going to get it right away. And I'm going to go borrow it and do this stuff. And it's like,
he's like, I hope they print. I'm going to step right up to the printer and I'm going to cash in. Right.
Well, gotta love his fucking honesty about it. But like, most people can't do that. Like, most people can't step right up to the printer and get that money. And that's the whole point. The poorest people are the last people to get that money. And they have to get it through a fucking credit card paying 17% or whatever it is, or 30%.
I think the greater issue is that people just don't understand how bad inflation is.
Yeah.
Because it's like that analogy of a frog in a pot of
getting boiled. Yeah.
You just raise it 1 degree at a time over a long period of time. And the next thing you know, the water's boiling and the frog didn't even notice and he gets boiled alive. Yeah. Right. So it's kind of, if you target a 2% rate of inflation compounding year over year, every 35 years ish, you're going to lose half your purchasing power.
Yeah.
So if you live to 70 years old, that happens twice in your life. So half your wealth gets taken from you twice.
That's wild.
In a lifetime.
It's like, wild for people. Most people even realize
that. That's at 2%. It's probably a lot higher than that.
But you're describing the United States, and the United States is like the nicest house on a shitty street. Like most of these other countries, like when I get people from South America, you talked about people teaching you about inflation in South America. Like when people come to our Bitcoin meetup and they don't know about Bitcoin and they're like South American and they come, they get it right away. They're like,
oh, sure.
Oh, Maddie, I get this. Like absolutely scarce. I get the inflation argument, but like most Western people, they're able to boil that frog for so long that like you don't even kind of feel it. I mean, people feel it. They don't realize they feel it. They're running this rat race. Like you talked about the system. They're just like spinning and spinning and spinning and spinning. But like, they might not intellectually grasp what exactly is happening, but like they get it because they invest in real estate and they invest in these things. They don't want to just hold. A lot of people are like, hey, let me pump it into real estate. I'm pumping it here because subconsciously they probably understand that they're getting debased. They might feel it in a certain way. And that's why housing itself has gotten a monetary premium, right?
And
it's causing a lot of problems in our civilization of second and third order effects of young people can't have families. They can't buy a house. We're on demographic decline. All of these issues, right, that are being caused are, in my opinion, stem from the root cause of the money.
I absolutely agree. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely agree with that. And I also think that from a demographic perspective, that we're going to see a really big correction in real estate. For multiple reasons. I mean, you've got have you ever seen these demographic charts where it shows the boomer generation is like this and the other generations are just much smaller in terms of how many people there are.
Uh-huh.
So over the next probably 10, 20 years, these people in that generation are reaching end of life, right? So what happens when they're gone? Who's going to buy those houses? You know, and as they reach end of life, many of them have to sell their homes to pay for medical care and end of life expenses, right? So who's going to buy all those houses? I mean, from a demographic perspective, just look at the numbers of
people. Yeah, it just
doesn't make sense. Right?
Well, the argument is we're going to bring in, 20 million third world people and the government's going to pay for those houses.
Or already has.
Which is what's happening right now. I mean, you know, you've got, they're just dropping off 50,000 Haitian immigrants or 50,000 Pakistani immigrants or 50,000 whatever immigrants and just dropping them off in the middle of these small cities or whatever and just creating this a massive cost. And they're wondering what's happening in New York City and all these places. And, you know, you've got, just mass immigration. They're all obviously voting for socialists and communists. You know, you import the third world, you're going to get those third world outcomes in a lot of scenarios, right?
Yeah, and you mentioned, you know, socialism, communism. And it's like, when people don't understand the reason why they can't afford things and they don't understand that like the story of you go to school, you work real hard, you get good grades, you get a good job, you're going to be okay. And they're like, well, okay, I followed that plan and now I have a couple $100,000 of student debt and I still can't
buy a house
and I'm still working this retail job, making no money. And I can barely afford groceries after I pay my rent. This is a perfect fertile ground for communist ideas to take root.
Well, we're seeing it happen right now.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's literally happening in New York City.
Absolutely.
Which is like the shining hill of capitalism in America. It blows my mind. Why do you, I mean, do you think it's more an immigration issue there? And that's why the votes have...
I think it's all of the above. We're in a fourth turning, man. You know, you've heard that. Yeah. You've heard that saying. Yeah. Hard times make strong men. Strong men make good times. Good times make weak men.
Yep.
Weak men make bad times. Bad times make strong men. So we're in the good times made weak men part. We're starting to see the bad times. Hopefully, it doesn't get much worse. We'll see. But I also think that the bad times make strong men thing is true. Cause if you look at the younger generations today, the ones coming up now, they're pretty hard.
Yeah.
Compared to the ones just before them. Right. So, that's an interesting thing. From my understanding, it's like the most conservative generation ever.
I saw that Gen Z, I think, is the most conservative generation.
Yeah, ever.
Yeah.
Right. So, who knows?
You know, my son is like, he's very right-leaning, I would say, more so than even I am. I think that's probably pretty accurate.
Yeah.
Like when they assassinated Charlie Kirk, I mean, that basically had the opposite effect, at least on him. He was like, who is this guy? I want to watch his videos. Started watching all of his videos, and now he's very leaning that way in a lot of ways. And I'm not
interesting.
Even, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think he kind of martyred him, and I think that's probably a good thing.
Oh, that's, well... I had no idea how much impact he had on people. Like,
yeah.
Like younger people, like he has had a massive, massive.
He's having an even more of an impact
now. Not just in the United States, but globally. Mm-hmm. Blew my mind.
Before we deviate off of this topic, I want to ask you one more gold question. Cause I always, whenever I have people that are involved in the gold community, and when I had like Dominic and Larry here, they talked a lot about how China has been importing so much gold geopolitically. They're basically lying about how much gold they're bringing in. Do you know anything about that? Like, what are your thoughts?
Man, it's fascinating.
And how can Bitcoin play into this geopolitics situation?
Okay, so it's fascinating that you asked me that question, because back in the day when I was involved in gold, our primary provider of gold back then was a refinery that is the largest refinery in the world. They do the majority of refining of what's called good delivery gold in the world. And we would, every year we would go over there, we would talk to the director, and we would hear from him what he was seeing. And he has a unique position in the industry. He's seeing the flows. And then also, you know, on occasion, we would go to different conferences and sit like that. And I can remember this one conference I had gone to, and I was sitting next to this guy who is in charge of global operations for Group 4 Securicore. They're one of the largest security logistics transport companies in the world. And he was explaining to me how they were moving caravans of gold from Russia into China in tanks. And this stuff was not reported. And there's an article, there's a guy that I did an interview with way back many years ago. And I think this is really the first time anybody really started talking about this, where I explained to him as like, there's way more gold going into China than they're reporting.
So it's fascinating that you're saying this, because Dominic is the only other person I've heard talk about this.
Yeah.
And he told me about it.
Yeah. So that was going on. I mean, and they were doing it off book. Here's the interesting thing. So it's like, sometimes people are like, well, no, I don't think I don't think China and Russia are buying any Bitcoin. And it's like, well, how would you know that? Because if a sovereign is accumulating an asset like that, if they actually consider it to be a strategic asset, they're not going to tell you.
Exactly. Especially their geopolitical adversaries, potentially.
Correct. Because when you do that, you're tipping your hands to every other one of your, basically your competitors, so to speak, right? So they're not going to do that. If nation states are accumulating gold right now, they're doing it in absolute secrecy. They're using off-book transactions. So the way China was doing a lot of their gold is they were using wealth funds that that the state actually controlled, but it was not on the books of China, so to speak.
Ah, that's so fascinating. So why Why was the gold going through Russia? Was it relocating from Russia to there, or were they just going through there?
No. They were mining it in Russia. Mm-hmm. China was buying it directly from the Russians, and they were moving it into China in tanks.
That's actually fascinating. And
the point of that is that that was avoiding all the traditional routes that you might be able to measure how much they were buying. It was a way to clandestinely move gold into China.
I think Dominic said they have like 5 to 10 times as much as they've been reporting. That's what
you're saying. Possibly.
So, I mean,
that wouldn't surprise me if that were true.
How do you think that plays into the, like where we're at with the dollar right now and how it's kind of lost a lot of value in the past year or two? And is the writing on the wall for the current world order system? Do you think we're going to still have the US dollar for a lot longer?
Yeah. I think it'll stick around for as long as it can. Now, whatever that means, you know, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 50 years, I'm not really sure. Mm-hmm. World reserve currencies do change from time to time. At one point, the Roman denarius was the world's world currency. Mm-hmm. And then it became the Byzantine, Byzant or Solidus or something like that. I don't remember.
Those were all still precious metal based in a lot of ways.
True. But the point is there was an empire mm-hmm. and their chosen currency was the coin of the world. Mm-hmm. So it was the known world at the time. And eventually it passed to country after country after country. Mm-hmm. Prior to the United States, it was England with the British pound was the world's reserve mm-hmm. and trade currency. And then it became the United States of America. Mm-hmm. Each one of those shifts took like 50 mm-hmm. Plus years. Right. So on average, I think the number is around 50 years. And if you think about, here's the interesting thing is that in 1971, we separated gold from the United States dollar. So we've been basically on a pure fiat system for going on, 30 something years?
No, it's hard to believe because
it's almost
I was born in the fucking 90s. Okay, so now, I think about it. Everything
30 plus 25. So that's like 54 years. Yeah. So that's about the amount of time it takes in between transitions.
Hmm.
Right. So then what do you see? Just a couple of years ago, the United States essentially locked Russia out of the US dollar transfer system.
Mm-hmm.
Some people are not going to like this, but I think that was a mistake.
Well, I mean, it's basically like one bullet in the chamber. After you use that bullet,
what are you really saying to the world? It's kind of like this. Yeah. If we're playing Monopoly and here's the Monopoly board, right? And I'm the United States and I'm the banker. Right. Everybody's using my money.
Mm-hmm.
Fantastic. It's a great position to be in. But like you're Russian. I'm like, you know, screw you. You can't play anymore. And he's sitting over there by himself going, okay, well, what do I do? The whole world is looking at that going,
oh shit.
You're telling me you can just like kick me off the board.
Yeah.
So then they all start talking to each other and going, we need alternative systems because that could be any of us. Right. And so what happened? You started seeing bilateral trade agreements between countries. Mm-hmm. They're settling trade in different currencies besides the United States.
You've got
dollar.
The BRICS situation coming out of the woodwork now.
You've got all that happening. So it used to, you look at like global trade used to be like 85% plus was settled in United States dollars. And then the amount that's settled in US dollars is dropping every single year. So you look at that and you start to realize, well, these guys are trying to look for other rails. This is, I think, is one of the reasons why stable coins have exploded in adoption, number one. But number two, this is one of the reasons, this is a twofold reason why the United States has embraced it. This is the Genius Act.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is actually genius if you want to keep your currency as the reserve currency of the world.
So they're like,
make it accessible to literally third world people and everybody globally who can use it kind of permissionlessly and buy your shitty debt.
So it does multiple things there, right? It maintains the US dollar as the supreme means of transfer, but it also acts as a moat for the banks. Because if you remember, you go back, just go look at the videos of Jamie Dimon, the head of JP Morgan at Davos every year for as long as you can remember. He's saying bad things about Bitcoin. I don't like it. It's for criminals, blah, blah, blah,
it's
blah.
It's a pet rock. That was his latest. Rock. But now all of a sudden they're accumulating it.
But so they passed the Stablecoin Act and they're like, okay, the banks can now issue these basically stable coins, but you have to do what? You have to buy US treasuries. So what does that mean? Now they're supporting the treasury market and they're creating a moat, they hope, I think, around the banking system in the United States. And I liken this to, we were talking a little while ago about that gentleman that used to work with, one of the large studios, Universal or something like that. And then Torrance came along. It basically completely disrupted their industry. Mm-hmm. And eventually the first thing they tried, they ignored it. They laughed at it. They mocked at it. Then they tried to regulate it out of existence and tried to use law to make it not a thing. And eventually they capitulated and they integrated with it. Now you have Spotify.
Wow.
Right. So this is the pathway. This is what's happening right now with the banking system. They're trying to regulate and create moats around their industries and protect their industries. But eventually they're just going to have to integrate.
Yeah, you're not wrong. Wow. It's crazy how this stuff plays out. How do you think Bitcoin plays into this whole geopolitical structure?
So I think Bitcoin becomes more akin to gold in the old system, right? It's capital. It's base layer capital, mm-hmm. basically.
I think the exact same thing.
Yeah. I don't think you're ever going to have derivatives is not something that's going to go away. Like when I say derivatives, a derivative is derived from something else. Orange juice is derived from an orange, mm-hmm. for example. A dollar, believe it or not, is a derivative of gold. You know, some people go, you ever hear the saying, what is Bitcoin backed by? The question itself implies that they believe that Bitcoin is a derivative of something else. Mm. There's some other underlying thing that Bitcoin is deriving its value for. So wow. The question to me is,
that's a good point.
You know, if somebody asks me that, it's like, okay, well, let me ask you this. What's backing gold? Nothing. It just is. That's Bitcoin. Mm. Nothing. It just is. It is base layer money, right?
Wow.
So I think you're going to continue to see currencies. You're going to continue to see national currencies. Mm. You'll see derivatives. The derivative market in gold, in Bitcoin is just now starting to get legs. Mm. You see all the stuff that's going on with like MSTR and all the preferreds they're issuing, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. This big trend with Bitcoin treasury companies, right? Mm-hmm. So yeah, recently that hasn't looked super great, but I think long-term companies that own Bitcoin as an asset, they're going to grow in terms of value faster than their competitors. If you have two exactly the same companies, you have, let's say it's a car manufacturer. Mm-hmm. They make basically the same vehicle, right? This company is divesting its capital. This company is stacking Bitcoin. In 20 years, which one is going to be worth more?
Obviously the one with digital capital.
Obviously the one that's stacking the Bitcoin, right? So I think that you're going to just see that continue to mature. And even though, you know, the Bitcoin treasury companies have taken hits lately, in terms of US dollars and where they're trading and whatnot, I think mm-hmm. long term, if they continue to stack Bitcoin, they're going to be worth way, way more than their peers over time.
How do you evaluate companies like MicroStrategy, these derivative companies? I got, obviously, if you're in Bitcoin, you heard about it a long time ago, you got in very early and it's like up massively along with Bitcoin, but would you rather just hold the physical asset, or do you think that there's a place in the portfolio for both? How do you think about that?
I think it depends who you are as an investor, really.
Yeah.
And I think it depends about how you want to. So,
let me ask you this. What do you think about Saylor's strategy? Because what made a lot of sense to me was that he basically said, and this is like when, for me, this was like, oh, I love this. He said that if you own MicroStrategy stock, all the little games he's playing, doing all these different things, he basically said, as time goes on, I'm going to return more sats per share of MicroStrategy stock to you. Mm. And to me, it was like, okay, that makes fucking sense. And that's all I care about at this point, personally.
Yeah, no, I tend to agree with that. I think at the end of the day, the most important thing is how much Bitcoin does that company own and how much Bitcoin does the company own per share. I think that's a pretty good metric to use. So as long as it's what he's calling accretive, meaning you're ending up with more Bitcoin per share, that's probably good. And he's way better at explaining this than I'm going to be. But the bottom line is if you can acquire capital that costs you less, then the Bitcoin's going to go up in value long term. That makes sense to do.
Mm-hmm. And, I agree.
You know, it's just like a lot of people would get mad. They're like, well, he's selling stock to buy more Bitcoin. It's like, look, Bitcoin is a once in a human
history
event. The adoption of Bitcoin is going to happen one time, not twice, not five times, one time. right? So if that's the case, you probably want to get as much as you can.
Wow. God, it's, I love talking to other Bitcoiners who like really have gone down the rabbit hole and have these just interesting insights. Because a lot of people just like we talked about earlier, it's like 95% of people don't own Bitcoin. And they, like you said, I think it was Tom Lee, you know, 95% of people don't have Bitcoin, don't understand it. And 95% of it's been mined, et cetera.
Right.
It's an interesting thought.
So there's the basically the whole rest of the human race. There's, there's the whole rest of the capital markets valuation, which is something like $900 trillion when you add in the value of real estate and stuff.
That's what I was adding up earlier. The other thing, yeah.
All the things.
It's closer to a quadrillion now.
Yeah, it's closer to a quadrillion. And that's not even including.
Yeah.
That's not even including.
That's what I was getting at.
The derivatives market, you know, which is an additional quadrillion and a half or whatever it is. For sure. I mean, it's just got a long, long, long way to go. So, and a lot of people are scared away because of something like Bitcoin because of volatility. And it's like, the way I think of it is, well, it's this tiny little asset. It's like $2 trillion compared to what, $900 trillion.
Yeah. I mean, that's,
so it's, think of it like this. Like if the Atlantic Ocean is a sea of capital and there's $900 trillion worth of capital floating around in there. And let's say gold is a $30 trillion asset. Gold is like an iceberg. And if there's water sloshing around, that's not going to move an iceberg that much. But if there's an ice cube that's $2 trillion worth of capital mass, it's going to move, right? I mean, this is just, it seems obvious to me.
Yeah, that was the question I wanted to ask Mike McGlone when he was talking about it yesterday. It was like, I wanted to break that down. It's like, well, if you think it's overvalued, we're like, it's less than like it's less than 100th of like 100th of a percent of all of the capital allocation right now in the world. Like, you know, what do you think, you know, rationally it should be at, right? What do you think this perfectly, you know, absolutely scarce base money should be, right? And obviously we both know that it's going to be a lot more than two quadrillion.
Sure.
Whatever. You know?
But see, he's probably never thought that through, which is the reason he thinks that.
Of course. Right? No doubt.
So it's just one of those things where it's not, a lot of people look at what Bitcoiners say and they go, well, that just sounds like a, you know, the kind of comments that Bitcoiners
make. Kind of what
Grant
was saying yesterday, Grant Cardone.
They elicit this feeling of like, well, that just sounds like a religion. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's like, there's no way that can be true.
Yeah.
The reason they think that, though, is because they haven't researched why Bitcoiners actually say those things, right? So you would have to.
Can't blame them. I mean, they purposely, you are not taught Austrian economics. You're not taught these things. I mean, you have to literally, you got to take that red pill or that orange pill and outside the system.
You're essentially fighting the entire academic system because
it's fiat, a whole fiat system. It is a fiat system.
The fiat economics profession. I mean, this is the crazy part. So here's the thing. We have fiat money, right? What does fiat money say? You have to have a 2% or higher rate of inflation to have a healthy economy. So what that's really saying is you have to steal half of everybody's purchasing power every 35 years at minimum to have a healthy economy. They've actually convinced the majority of people that this is true. And if you ask any modern economist today, academics,
that's the consensus.
So it's kind of like, to me, that's the religion. Mm. You've got these academics who are, you know, dressed up as scientists saying that this is the way it needs to be. But how, like, you've actually convinced all these people that that's somehow good?
Yeah, you're stuck inside the matrix.
That is, you know, mind-blowing, man.
It really is when you start to understand Austrian economics, and it's so obvious how that is such a better system to understand human nature and economics at writ large, you know?
And then you start,
it was like all of us laughing when they printed all this stimulus money. They're like, you know, you got all these talking heads on TV, these fiat economists going on and saying that there's going to be no inflation. It's like, you just literally increased the money supply by 50% by pressing a couple buttons. You don't think there's going to be inflation?
But see, they have this disconnect in their mind. They do not relate the two things together because they have all these different variables and they say, well,
it's transitory and this and that, and there's not going to be any inflation. And
let me give you 1,000 reasons why prices are increasing that has nothing to do with the money we just printed. Right.
I mean, it's like the elephant in the room. It's so fucking obvious. If you study Austrian economics, we were like, I'm sitting here laughing and just like, you know, Bitcoin's at what crashed it. It was like $2,000 or something. It was like, Bitcoin is going exponentially higher here. It's like,
you know, what's even more fascinating is once you start going down the rabbit hole of the natural state of a free market is deflation. Now, you've probably heard this from Jeff Booth, right?
Jeff Booth. Canute and Jeff, yeah.
Yeah, the natural state of a free market is deflation. Well, what does that actually mean? This means as humans, we get better at doing stuff.
Of course.
We our technology increases, our knowledge increases.
It should go down forever.
The cost of things, technically, if the money supply remained constant, the cost of all things should go down forever. And once you start wrapping your brain around that one, that's like, wow.
Yeah.
So like, this is the reason why everything measured in Bitcoin is collapsing in cost. Measured in Bitcoin. Why? Because Bitcoin is the first finite thing the human race has ever seen. One might say it's the first time we've ever accurately been able to measure economic output. Because every other...
I think Parker Lewis, I think when I first came to Bitcoin, I watched the talk he did. I think it might have been with, I can't remember who, but he kind of talked about this. It's like, we've never had a stable measuring stick ever. So how can you even, how can you calculate all these statistics and stuff that the government puts out when the money's inflating and, oh, GDP's up. Well, is it really up or is it just
inflation? What you have to do is you have to continually add complexity to your models.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of like what happens around the time of Copernicus, right? When these guys started, when these brilliant dudes started to figure out, okay, well, maybe everything doesn't actually revolve around the Earth. These are these new observations that I'm making. And what happened was all the scientists of the time,
of course,
updated their models to account for the observations that were occurring instead of going, oh, yeah. Maybe everything does revolve around the sun. What they did instead was they updated the complexity of their models to say, no, everything really does still revolve around the Earth. They were absolutely wrong, but that was the dogma of the time.
Yeah.
You understand?
Yeah. We have
so
this,
it's very similar
quote that we put, I have a statistics degree and it's a statistics based degree. And there's this quote that we use that like all models are wrong. Some are useful. So
that's good.
You know, there's been all these Bitcoin models and all these different halving models and all these different things. And like we you know, we show, I put this on the title when we do our, we talk to a new potential like curated mining client to set up a mining LLC to do Bitcoin mining. And we put the models up but it's like all models are wrong. Some are useful. We try to make it as useful as possible, but you know, you can't control price. You can't control difficulty. You can't control all these factors and that changes the calculations obviously. But very interesting. So Alex, how did you even come across Bitcoin to begin with? I don't think I ever asked you that.
Man,
how did you find Bitcoin?
I had, well, being involved in the gold industry, that came on my radar very early. I first heard about it in 2011.
Wow.
And like an idiot, I did not take it seriously.
You Peter Schiff'd
it. I absolutely Peter Schiff'd it. I was like, this is complete nonsense. This is like, you know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of like magic internet money, like like World of Warcraft. Like you have this fake, you know, digital gold. And I'm like, yeah, it's like that. I also thought A, the government would shut it down. And B, it was probably just a gigantic bubble. Right. And so obviously I was wrong about those things. And I think it was probably 2019. So in 2017 is the first, take that back. The first time I ever bought some Bitcoin was 2015. And I think I dropped like $500 on Bitcoin and I promptly lost the wallet. Forgot all about it.
I did the same shit when I started mining and stuff. I didn't understand wallets. I was like,
it was an account that was basically tied to the phone number. Then I moved from Panama to the United States and I lost the phone number. So I lost access to the Bitcoin. Thankfully they contacted me and said, hey, you've got all this, they contacted me back, I think it was 2019, 18, somewhere in there. And they're like, hey, we've got this Bitcoin. And it's worth like $25,000. Do you want it? I'm like, yeah, I want it. But, anyway, in 2017,
so did you actually get it back?
I got it back.
That's fucking awesome.
Yeah, it was very cool. 2017, I had bought some and then I sold it at the end and I thought I was a genius. So I was an idiot. And I just thought, you know, this is just a bubble like Beanie Babies or Pet Rocks or some other fad. We're never going to hear from this thing again. 2019, I'm looking at charts and I'm thinking this thing is consolidating. It's going to run again. And that pissed me off because I sold it all. My guy was like, why is this even here? The government should have shut it down by now. And I started studying to answer that specific question. Why is this still here? Why hasn't the government shut it down? And what I learned was, oh, they can't.
Mm.
That's why it's still here. And that's what started me kind of going down the rabbit hole. And I was like, okay, well, if I was wrong about that, what else was I wrong about?
Oh, this is super interesting.
Yeah.
Do you think Peter Schiff is full of shit, or do you think he's just he actually believes it? You think he's still mad because he just keeps missing out? Like, where do you think he's at as a former gold bug?
I think him antagonizing Bitcoiners is the best source of engagement he can possibly get.
Yeah.
And he's really good at it.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know how much gold he's sold because of his antics. honestly, I suspect he owns some, and he just...
Well, I know he does now, because I think he set up an address and people started sending Bitcoin to the address for him just to get him skin in the game.
I suspect the whole thing is a theater, and it's great marketing.
It is great marketing.
Yeah.
I can't wait till he opens up his Schiff Bitcoin fund.
Yeah, maybe we'll see.
Oh man. What do you think about knots and core and all this stuff? Do you think that that's largely just like a lot of noise? Or are you seriously like involved in those debates? And
yeah, not really. I mean, I do follow it. Mm-hmm. I'm not super worried about it. I don't think it's like existential. I don't think it's going to like permanently damage Bitcoin or anything like that. Mm-hmm. I'm not super worried about it. There's interesting arguments on both sides. My bigger concern is I think the arguments actually scare new people away from Bitcoin.
Mm.
People who find those arguments. And to be fair, probably 95% of people who are looking at Bitcoin.
That's how I feel.
No idea.
That's literally what I've been saying as well. Yeah. Like most people have no clue what knots is, and what they don't run their own node. They don't know what core is. I mean,
you have to be pretty deep down the sort of social media, Twitter rabbit hole.
Your algorithm has to be pretty tuned to those conversations. And most people just are not even seeing any of that.
That's something that clued, when I was working at Swan, that's something that clued me into the fact that, the people who are on X talking about crypto or Bitcoin or whatever is actually a tiny fraction of the population.
So.
Yeah, because I would have all these new clients coming in and they have no idea.
No clue.
No idea.
Yeah. But 99% of people I talk to don't have any clue about any of that stuff. Yeah. And they're just, learning about Bitcoin's they're just starting the journey of their Bitcoin education.
Sure.
Or they understand the idea of absolute scarcity and they see the long-term returns and like, this is really cool. But I actually completely agree with you. I think that, it's not a big issue.
No,
I think it's more of a nothing burger.
And it's certainly not going to stop adoption. Yeah.
I think it's cool though that people can run. You can run knots if you want to, and you can run, core if you want to.
Sure.
And like I'm running not the newest core, but the core right before that,
Interesting you say that's actually the reason why. So some people say that Bitcoin has been co-opted by five core maintainers, that is the weak point.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And it's kind of like, I was talking to Tomer Strohlite about this morning on my show.
Mm-hmm.
And basically if they were to release a version of the software that was truly counter to everyone's interests in Bitcoin,
just don't run it.
They won't run it.
Yeah, it's that simple.
That's your option. It's that simple.
It's really that simple.
So these folks that think the CIA invented it and controls it and all they have to do is tell the core maintainers, you do what we want you to do, they don't understand that doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to have the consensus. If the people don't agree, then it doesn't matter what you put out there. Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to use it. Right. And the interesting part about that is that essentially the network protects itself. Why? Because every single human that's involved has self-interest, and it's the behavioral incentive of the individuals that makes up the whole network. Right. And that's what it protects itself, because humans are always going to do what's in their own best interest if they understand what the options are.
I find it so fascinating, because when you start to look at models of the world that make sense, when you start to look at Austrian economics and game theory and some of these things, you can tell that when Satoshi designed this system, he had no misgivings about human nature. He understood that people were self-motivated, that man was imperfect, right? Which is why socialism and communism always fails, because man is not perfect. They are imperfect. We are all imperfect. We all operate out of our own incentives and self-interest. And, you know, what sounds good on the surface is obviously it always ends in massive tragedy, because the fundamental building block of that idea is flawed and broken.
Right.
So I'm always so fascinated to see how Satoshi, I sometimes go back and reread a lot of the old Bitcoin Talk forum posts and just see where his frame of mind was on many things. And it's just so fascinating how well he understood the history of money,
right.
Austrian economic principles, you know, human psychology, game theory.
Right.
It really is, you know, it is almost a religion in the sense that this is a once in human history invention that's been created here.
Yeah.
And it took a brilliant genius to see all these things and put all these puzzle pieces together to solve the novel computer science problems, like the Byzantine generals problem. And it's almost a spiritual thing in a lot of ways, which is what you like religious, like it, once you fully go down the rabbit hole and start to learn about these things, it is like almost a spiritual experience to see how this all works and how it all came together and why it is so important for humanity, right? To have this decentralized system that is permissionless, that is decentralized, that does have absolute scarcity, and take together all these ideas and create this tool for human freedom.
And to simplify things, because a lot of what you just said are essentially Bitcoiner terms, right? Mm-hmm. And if someone's new and they're listening to this, they're like, I have no idea what this is. But to make it super simple, like if Bitcoin is going up in value, let's say 30 to 40% a year, and it's beating every other asset in existence, it finally provides you some hope that you're not going to be stuck on that hamster wheel forever. And I think that is really, when you strip away all the complexity, that is the really, really amazing part for humanity. Because if you shunt your, we all create wealth, every single one of us. Basically what that means is you work, you exchange your time and your energy in service for, you know, currently dollars, whatever. You spend a certain amount of that meeting your basic needs. Everything above that is discretionary income, AKA wealth. So the question at that point is, what do you put it into, right? So if you're shunting that all into Bitcoin, you're finally, for the first time, creating a way where you can someday step off that hamster wheel. And for most people, that's just something that's just impossible.
So out of reach.
Yeah.
When you describe it that way, it always brings me back to this idea of physics and energy. And it's like, you know, your life's energy, you work for something, you want to be paid, and, you know, you're rewarded for that with money. And Bitcoin is this money that's tied to physics and energy. Mm-hmm. To me, that is like so fascinating, the connection there. It's almost like even with gold throughout human history, right? Like it wasn't easy to get the gold. It required a mass amount of energy to get that gold, that proof of work, that element is another factor. And we, you know, that's what mining is. It's proof of work. And I was always so fascinated by that. And like we were talking earlier a little bit about, you know, how I got involved in this whole thing and I learned about Bitcoin. I was like, how the hell can I participate in this? And, you know, I was a college athlete. So this whole idea of like proof of work, it was like, it spoke to me, right? To like, how can I participate in the system? Sadly, Bitcoin had just gone from like GPUs to ASICs. So at the time I was like, how do I get an ASIC? Like, and I go online and I'm like looking and it's like, oh my God, this is thousands of dollars and I got to have a 220 volt outlet. And like, I only have a bedroom I can use. Like, what's going on here?
Right.
So I actually was pushed to, that's how I found out about Ethereum, when I can use GPUs to mine. Right.
Right.
And I think a lot of people don't realize that what built Ethereum into what it was the fact that people could permissionlessly just participate in consensus, kind of how they did with Bitcoin originally.
Yeah. It was easier to access.
And like, I could go and I built a rig and I was like, you know, I watched the YouTube video and just try to copy this guy and like, you know, put the GPUs in and boom, all of a sudden I'm trading electricity for, you know, some kind of monetary unit, some kind of a thing. It was pretty cool. It was like, and then you could participate in an ecosystem and that kind of like brought people in, right? It's like anybody can permissionlessly participate in this.
Sure.
I thought was really fucking cool.
Yeah, that is cool. I mean, just the evolution of all of this stuff is really fascinating to see. And I agree with you. I actually, in 2017, I was messing around with it too. ASICs had been around for a little bit. I remember exactly when they started, but I was like, you know, I'm not going to buy an ASIC. So I did, just out of curiosity, because I wanted to understand how this stuff works. Mm-hmm. I built a 12 GPU rig,
okay,
and I was mining, I don't know, something, but I was selling it immediately.
Oh, really?
Yeah, for cash. And I don't even remember what I spent the money on. I kind of, at the time, I wish I bought it. I used it all to buy Bitcoin, but
really,
hindsight, whatever.
Yeah, I mined, when I first started mining, I like didn't know I had to put my wallet. I didn't understand public and private keys, which is like, right, if you're new to Bitcoin, it's like, you know, that's what makes Bitcoin so powerful, that you control that password to move that money around, whether, yeah, or that crypto asset around. And I just didn't understand. So I just like, how do I access my account? And I'm just like mining like hundreds of ETH, the developer.
Oh my gosh.
And eventually I figured it out, like, oh, I have to generate my own pair of public and private keys.
Wow.
Well, so, I mean, again, like, you know, everybody, you make a mistake and you learn from it, right? And I'm like, okay, I understand now. I do more research, and like, you know, Bitcoin is like this onion, and just this, these ideas, you kind of peel back and you learn more and you learn more, and you're like, you just keep peeling back this onion, and there's so much interesting stuff there. I mean, yeah, I'm always still learning, you know, even on these podcasts, I learn new things, talking to interesting people like yourself. Yeah. It's like, it's super, super fascinating.
All the time. Do you, okay. So you hear this, probably a lot, where people think that they're too late.
Yeah. Hear that a lot.
You know, it's like, it's over 100,000 per Bitcoin. I'm just too late. I missed it. So like, I shouldn't buy Bitcoin.
Yeah.
What do you say to that?
Well, I try to explain what we talked about, how early you really are. Yeah. You know, I like to break out the S curve of adoption, and I show people that, and I say, look, you know, this is like, I compare it to the internet days. Like, people, this is like the 90s of the internet. Like, this is where we're at right now. This is how many percentage of the population that it's like that understand this, and are, and like, look how important the internet is today. You use it for everything you do, and you don't even realize.
Totally. Like,
these people here, this is Paul Krugman, the Keynesian economist, saying that the internet is going to be no more important than the fax machine, right? Like,
right,
you're missing the forest for the trees here. Yes. And that's the way that the fiat mindset operates, you know, and I explain that, you know, we're still so early. Like you said, most people still don't own Bitcoin, don't understand it. You know, even huge $1 billion allocators, like we watched yesterday, they don't understand it. They say 0%. I mean, it's like, there's such an asymmetry of information still.
Absolutely.
That, and that's why we say dollar cost average, just, you know, boom, over time,
sure,
cost, automate it, set it up, forget it. Don't worry about it. Don't worry if the price goes up, if the price goes down, if all these things happen, none of that matters. Keep going down the rabbit hole and understanding more, understand the fundamentals. And then that will, like, the more you learn, I've never met anybody that's learned more about Bitcoin and got less bullish on Bitcoin. Like, yeah. I still haven't met anybody like that.
Well, I mean, anybody who doesn't have a lot of, you know, either confirmation or sunk cost bias, mm-hmm, right? Where they don't, we were talking about this earlier, is like, sometimes you have a financial incentive to not understand.
Yeah.
Right. So as long as you're not that person, if you're open-minded and you're a critical thinker and you're willing to spend some time investigating, I don't know anybody who doesn't have bias. We all have bias, but I mean, sunk cost bias or some other financial incentive to not understand it, who's smart and spends, you know, 100-ish plus hours looking at it, who doesn't go like, oh, wow, that's interesting, which leads to more study. And then once you get to, you know, somewhere between probably 500 and 1,000 hours of looking at it, that's when the red light bulbs really start going on. And you're like, okay, I know why these guys say the things they say now.
Yeah, no, you're not wrong. And you actually, you know, it's, what's interesting is you have to put the proof of work in to get there. You have to actually rewire your brain and your programming to, like, actually understand.
Because you've been taught a certain thing your whole life. I mean, think about people who are like 40 or 50 years old.
It's tough.
Yeah. And they've gone their whole life. They went to, some of them went to economics classes where they were taught Keynesian economics. And I mean, even to this day, you talk to an economics guy from traditional economics, and then they're absolutely convinced that expanding the money supply is necessary. And it's just mind blowing.
Pretty crazy. Honestly absurd.
Yeah.
Oh. How do you think we get past this with the, like, you know, this phase of Bitcoiners only reaching other Bitcoiners? How do we break out of these echo chambers to reach the people we just talked about now? Obviously, you probably experienced this with family offices and some high net worth clients, but just in general, like you said, everybody, like, we kind of talked about crypto Twitter. It's like this underground thing. How do we reach more people? What do you think messages resonate?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just going to happen naturally. Over time. And I say that because, like, people go through phases when they get exposed to Bitcoin. First, it's basically disbelief or, you know, denial or whatever. I mean, basically everybody who thinks Bitcoin is a good thing today, almost every single one of them thought it was not at one point. Right. And they got over that, and something got them over that. Usually it was some human who said something or wrote something or was in a video or whatever the case may be. So we go through these phases where it's at first we're essentially deniers, unbelievers, whatever you want to call it, anti-Bitcoin. Then you start to study it and you have one of those light bulb moments. Then you study it more and you have a lot more light bulb moments. At one point you go through what I call the one-way door. Where once the human mind is expanded to a certain degree, it will never go back to its former dimensions, right? So this is like Bitcoin. Once you reach that point, you're never going back. You're never going, oh, I'm going to forget everything I just learned and go back and say,
like, I know I took the red pill, but never mind. Let me get the blue pill.
Yeah. It's like, no, bro, you're out of the matrix. You've been ejected. You're not going back in. All right. It's like, you're not going.
You found out you were in that pod being fed to aliens or whatever.
Right. Yeah. You're not going back in there. And then Bitcoiners go through this phase of evangelism where anybody within, you know, X distance.
Because you want to like teach other people what you know.
Let me tell you all about Bitcoin. And there's a certain period of time where you're just trying to convince everybody. It's like your waitress and the guy who washes your car. Just everybody, let me tell you about it. You know, it's like that's
just not ready for it, man.
That's what you start to figure out. Mm-hmm. Eventually you get to the point where it's like, okay, you know what? I'm just not going to say anything. Mm-hmm. And if someone wants to know, they're going to ask you. That's your opportunity. Mm. And the thing is that because every Bitcoiner has gone through the one-way door, we all have an incentive for the rest of the humanity to learn about it, right? So it's a mind virus, and it only goes in one direction.
That is true, yeah.
It's, right? It's
ideas. It's, you know, oh, there's a quote about like when an idea has met its time, when a good idea has come or something like that. Yeah. Like, what's that quote? I can't think. Paul, can you look that up? I can't remember what.
Oh, it's just that idea of like when, you know, when its time has come. Mm.
Yeah. An idea that's time has come. So it's so let me tell you a quick story. I had dinner with Bob Burnett. He's the CEO of Barefoot Mining.
He's a buddy of mine.
A couple nights ago. He's a great guy.
We do like a 4-hour podcast getting into technical shit sometimes. Like,
yeah, well, he's smart dude. Yeah. I mean, think guys like you, most of the guys who are involved in mining, you understand
this stuff on a very
technical level, right?
He's way above my pay grade too.
He's above most. He's probably, you know, there's maybe a dozen people in the world who understands this stuff at that level to the degree that like, well, I can't talk about it. You'll see. I won't say anything more about that. What I will say though, is that he mentioned how he used to go to these conferences in Vegas for computers, for PCs.
Gateway. I think he was the CTO.
He was the chief technical officer of Gateway Computer. He used to go, this was in the early 90s.
I was barely born.
Yeah. and he would talk about how like the attendance at these conferences in Vegas would go up every year. And in something like 1998, it peaked at like 225,000 people.
Wow.
At this conference. And I was blown away by that. I was like, man. So that's how you knew like PCs, like it was a thing.
Were you at the Vegas conference this year?
Yeah.
The Bitcoin Vegas conference.
Yeah. So it was like, 25,000-ish people.
God, I felt like so many people. I don't think I've ever been to a conference with so many people.
Think of it. That would have to be 10x for that to be the signal that Bitcoin is now being adopted like mainstream.
Wow.
Here's the other interesting thing he said to me. He goes, like a couple of years after that, nobody went to that conference.
Mm.
225,000 people down to nothing. And it occurred to me, I was like, so what you're telling me is that it became ubiquitous. Everyone was just doing it and weren't thinking about it. It's like everyone's driving a car. You don't really think about it anymore. So we're early for those people who are like, well, you know, I've missed it. It's $100,000. No, you have not missed it.
Yeah. We're still at, like I said, 10, like a less than 1/1000th of a percent or something ridiculous of like overall supply.
It's
capital allocation.
And the number of people who understand it or own any significant amount of it. It's just tiny, tiny, tiny.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's so interesting when you zoom out and think about these ideas.
I just want to throw this in real quick. I was talking to Gary Cardone yesterday because I saw on X, he had posted that he's selling his home and he's asking for, you know, $14 million. Very beautiful property. Mm-hmm. But I said, hey, why are you selling your place, man? You know, you're in Florida. It's prime real estate. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, because 10 years from now, that's going to be worth $100 million, right? Yeah. Like, why would I not liquidate right now, buy Bitcoin, you know, and then zoom out and be very happy that I did.
Yeah.
So I thought, hey, that's the right mindset.
Wow. Yeah,
that's the right mindset. So, I mean, the moral of the story is you buy Bitcoin and you wait. One of my favorite videos, I've got a copy of this video where it's basically a guy on his phone streaming through the transactions that he did in Bitcoin when this guy was basically buying $30 worth of Bitcoin a day, and he did it for 8 years. Oh. So the total amount of total amount was like 87,000 and some change that he spent buying Bitcoin. Bitcoin's all worth more than $1 million today.
That's unbelievable. It really makes you think about this idea of time preference. Want to unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So sure. So the hardest part of all of this really is the discipline of waiting. And we're in our society today where everything trains us that you need to do everything now. You need to have everything now. You have microwaves. Yep. You need your food now. You need to go to, you know, do the drive-thru. You need to have it now. Everything's got to be like right now. You're not going to
delay gratification. Get out of here.
Yeah. Having the discipline to wait is very difficult. And Bitcoin punishes people who can't wait and rewards people who can. And here's a really interesting phenomenon. I've talked to many, many Bitcoiners about this, and they all say something similar, whereas like the discipline of converting dollars into Bitcoin and then waiting for that gratification has completely changed them as human beings. A lot of their value systems start to change. A lot of the things that they thought were important, really, they realize actually aren't important. They stop chasing. They stop chasing the trappings of life that are probably they're things that might feel good in the short term, but they essentially numb you to what's really important. They're just numbing that and satisfying you and making you okay with the idea that you have to run on that hamster wheel again tomorrow. And again and again and again, and you never get to get out. You get to have to run faster every year just to try to keep up.
Have you heard of that psychological experiment? I think it's the Stanford Marshmallow Experiment, where you haven't heard of this? Oh, this is super cool. So what they did, this experiment where they like took kids at a young age, and they did what they call the Marshmallow Experiment, and they tracked them throughout their lives. And what they found was that the kids they basically went in and said, hey, you know, here's one marshmallow. I'll be back in 5 minutes. If you don't eat this marshmallow for 5 minutes, when I get back, I'll give you two marshmallows.
Right.
And what they found was that the kids that were able to delay gratification and wait to get that second marshmallow did way better throughout life. They were way more successful. Just from that one measurement of thing that they measured. Yeah. After they track these kids throughout their lives.
Yeah, that's fascinating.
It's pretty fascinating.
Yeah. Well, it comes down to the whole thing about discipline, right? Mm-hmm. Discipline is really the key to almost everything at the end of the day.
I've really been stewing on this. I want to write something. I'm not really a writer, but I've been like really thinking after talking to Knut and having like some conversations with him about this idea. This idea about how money affects a society, and it trains the way people act and behave, and it kind of programs... and thinking, listening to, reading through, you know, Keynes talking with Friedrich Hayek and people like that, and they're having conversations about, you know, economic systems and, you know, this whole idea of Keynesian economics being animal spirits. We want to just, you know, we want to, you know, print money so they need to spend the money because that, you know, you just keep going and going and going and going, and you're just running, like you said, this hamster wheel. And I think Hayek said to Keynes, he said, well, what about the future? And Keynes said, in the future, we're all dead. That was his response.
Yeah.
So that response was kind of like, well, what do you mean in the future? We're all dead. We've got kids, we've got families, we've got all this stuff. It was kind of like just this idea that, well, fuck the future, fuck the people, fuck the generations that are coming.
Right.
So
that's precisely right.
Yeah.
So, which has spawned an economic system that has produced that exact result.
And not only that, not only does it permeate just monetary things, but it just affects the culture of your civilization about,
undoubtedly,
you know, no, there's a victim mindset and, you know, no accountability and no discipline. And it's just this hamster wheel of spend on frivolous things that nobody really needs. You know, like I watch my wife, like the stuff she buys, like I love her, but like, do we need all of these things, these little toys and trinkets that we're giving away and throwing away? It's like, it's just create this consumerist society. And it all comes back to the money.
I agree with that. It affects the institutions. It affects the morality of the people. It affects so many different things. It affects the way businesses create products. Mm-hmm. If you have this consumerist mentality where you need to constantly churn and constantly buy, mm-hmm. Flip it for a second and think of it like this. Like, if you had money that you knew was increasing in purchasing power all the time, are you more or less likely to spend it?
Of course, less
you're,
likely to spend
you're it. Less likely to spend. You're yeah. more likely to hold on to it for a longer period of time. And if you do spend it, what you spend it on precisely, right? So if that's true, then what that means is what all of the consumers will want is the thing of higher quality, not lower mm-hmm. quality. Which means the things that are going to be produced, if you want to succeed as a business person, mm-hmm. must be higher quality,
yeah.
not lower quality. It literally changes the entire dynamic of how industry and things are produced works, just based upon what kind of money we have.
It's fascinating ideas. Do you have any closing thoughts for us, Alex, before we wrap here?
Yeah, I just want to reiterate that I think Bitcoin really is hope. I really believe that. I my heart goes out to the younger generations, you know, who are just trying to make it, and they're looking at the system that they've been handed, and they're just like, man, this is not great. They have a right to believe that. But I would say, you know, there's a lot of hostility, I should say, towards boomers. And they're like, it's all you guys' fault. And it's like, look, this problem started a long, mm-hmm. long time ago. 1913, the creation of the Federal Reserve System was part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Got progressively worse.
Bretton Woods in 1944, 1971, mm-hmm. they removed the gold standard. A lot of this stuff happened before mm-hmm. a lot of these people were even alive.
True.
This was baked into the cake over 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. All right. So understand what the problem is and then understand what the solution is. The solution is to achieve what I call escape velocity. To achieve escape velocity, mathematically, if you're going to go exchange your time in like a job and you're going to exchange your time for money mm-hmm. and then try to follow the traditional advice of just work real hard and you're going to be okay. I'm not trying to scare you, but that's not true. It's not going to be okay. You need to stop listening to that and earn as much as you possibly can, reduce your expenses to as low as you possibly can, create as much delta as possible between those two different things, mm-hmm. take as much as you can and put it into Bitcoin as you can, and do it for 4 or 5 years, and don't touch it, don't sell it, don't trade it, don't do all those things, just sit on it, let it accumulate. That's the best shot you've personally, I believe that you have.
Bitcoin is hope. Alex Danzik, what a conversation.
Thanks, brother. Thanks for having me.